Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. Today, I'm going to give you a quick update of what's happening in the art world and the collectible world, et cetera, et cetera. And then at the bottom of the hour, I'm having a wonderful guest join us, and Jennifer Jackwood. Jennifer has been around in town doing all sorts of things in the art world. She ran the thrift store at the Music Academy of the West for years. She's gone on to great things, and she's going to join us and tell us a little bit more about what's going on in Santa Barbara as far as the arts are concerned. I want to start by a really interesting story that crossed my desk. I didn't know this, but Richard, you know, the singer Madonna has an idol, and her idol is Frida Kahlo, who is a great artist, Mexican artist. And she sparked an outrage amongst Frida Kahlo lovers, which there's many of us. She posted online about her experience trying on the late artist's clothing and jewelry in the artist's former home in Mexico. Well, a lot of fans thought that the building Madonna was referring to was the Frida Kahlo Museum, the Casa Azul. And the Casa Azul started to get a number of phone calls and emails saying, why are you letting her try on Frida Kahlo's clothing and jewelry? What's happening? And anyway, it was a misunderstanding. Madonna had made an appointment with the family of Frida Kahlo and went to their home, in which they had their own private collection of clothing and jewelry that Frida had owned. And they allowed her to try on Frida Kahlo's clothes and jewelry. And the thing is that this is a real hot button issue now, since one of the Kardashians wore Marilyn Monroe's gown to one of the galas, and she borrowed the gown from the Met Institute of Costume. See, museums, Richard, and institutions like this, they don't lend out clothing. If they're collecting it, they just do not do that. And so this made headlines because it was like, okay, why is the museum allowing this to go on? That's our first story of the day. And Richard, can you see me? I know you guys are on radio. You're listening on radio.
Oh, yeah, I can see you. Yeah.
Okay, can you see this picture? What is that?
Well, it looks like a fish.
It's a big shark.
Big shark. That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's a big shark. And he's in a big tank. And that's a tank that's filled with formaldehyde.
Yo!
And yes, so this is a photograph taken in February of this year. And that is an artwork of a once live shark, now in formaldehyde. The work is entitled Heaven. It's from the series Natural History. And the series is made of animals immersed in tanks of formaldehyde. And this was done by artist Damien Hirst, British artist Damien Hirst. He's got a show right now on called The Light That Shines in southeastern France at a museum there. He's got sculptures, paintings, installations, and things that he has done, the very famous artist, that he's done that people have not seen before. And he's taken over all of the vineyards. So the museum is an old chateau, and he's taken over all the vineyards around the chateau. And what's interesting about that is that he has said that these are new works in many cases. And the shark that you just saw in formaldehyde, there was also a famous goat in formaldehyde, et cetera. He's done doves, sharks, two calves, et cetera, all in formaldehyde. Well, they're supposed to be from a series that he did in the 1990s, the mid-1990s, where he was at his absolute peak of genius, people say. These pieces were set, they said in the museum, the Chateau, well, these pieces have never been seen before. They're from the 1990s. And it gathered a huge crowd because people were really interested to see the work that's ancient work by Damien Hirst, ancient being 1990s. Well, it turns out that I guess somebody tested one of the waters, you could call it, waters from Ella. Anyway, they said that these are not old works. These are modern works. These are done very, very recently. So they interviewed the artist. Well, what did the artist have to say? He said, age is a concept.
Okay.
And he said, my works are conceptual artwork, and the date that I first assigned them, in other words, the date that they occurred to him in his imagination, is the date of the conception of the work. So, Richard, we are not as old as you think we are. Age is a concept.
Okay.
And now we're undergoing our fires, but there's been a recent fire in France at a Notre Dame cathedral. There's many cathedrals that are called Notre Dame, but this brings to mind the 2019 inferno at the Notre Dame in Paris.
Yes.
This happened at Notre Dame in Rouen, France. It was a firefight that went on for 1 hour, thankfully. It was on one of the highest spires, the 500-foot spire at the Gothic church. And the crowd came out to watch the firefighters scaling this huge spire. And why is that cathedral famous? Well, it's famous because Monet painted the facade of this cathedral in various lights again and again and again and again, and made that cathedral kind of immortal in his paintings. And by the way, it's the 150th anniversary of the birth of the style, Impressionism. So thankfully the church was spared. Not a lot of damage apparently, just a lot of water damage. But another fire as we're undergoing our fires. And Richard, how are you doing? You're up there in 154. Do you see the smoke and feel the fire?
Well, we don't feel the fire, but we do see the smoke when the winds pull it over the top of the mountain. I will say that one of the newest advances that they have had is they have cameras up on top of San Ynez Mountain. It's actually due south of Kachuma Lake, and it's a 360-degree panorama view to where when you log in and you look at the images, they are from the moment you've logged in, and you can do 360 degrees around. So I can see the plumes of smoke. And last night, just about lost my mind when I saw a tiny little plume of smoke off to the far eastern portion of the mountainside of the area where the Ray fire started. And I was out of my mind thinking, who is the stupid moronic idiot who did whatever they did to start that fire, which thank God was only 11 acres. But it's like, are you kidding me? Are you seriously kidding me? Bear in mind, I'm a pacifist. I am not a fan of capital punishment. But I got to tell you, there are times when I'm thinking the punishment needs to match the crime.
Oh my goodness! So that's really cool. How do you access this site that you're talking about, the 360 degrees?
Well, I'll give that to you. Actually, the way you can access it, you go to fire.ca.gov. That's fire.ca.gov. And as you scroll, it'll give you a graphic image of the perimeter, if you will, of the fire area. Then you scroll down and you will see a picture, and that is actually a snapshot of the camera view. But underneath that picture, there is a link that will take you to the panoramic view, and they have two cameras up there. And it's really, it's really very cool. So go to fire.ca, fire.ca.gov. Go down to that image, that picture that you see, and then click on the link down underneath the image, okay? And it'll take you to the website where you will be able to see a panoramic view of the entire both the mountainside, the valley there, and then all the way around to the beach side where you'll see the marine layer, all that good stuff. I watched the sunset through that camera. Now, it's not a live video. It's literally a 360-degree snapshot at the moment you log in to that camera. And then you can.
Interesting.
Oh, I'm so glad they have it. We're doing well. I'm looking forward to cooler temperatures. I know the firefighters are as well. And as I've said probably many times, my hat is off to them figuratively and literally. I don't envy them their job, but I am so proud of the fact that they are there doing the work that I wouldn't and couldn't do. And I'm so thankful that they're doing what they're doing. And folks, don't worry about what you see in the camera and the perimeter. The fire's going to get larger only because they are preparing containment lines farther away from the perimeter of the fire to where they're going to let the fire come to them. They'll do some back burning and that kind of thing to prepare the area so that when the fire does reach that containment area, hopefully without weather interference, it'll stop. So this will be over. I don't know how long it's going to take, but I'm just glad those men and women are out there, and I hope that they stay safe. Thank goodness, only 4 injuries thus far. I think 3 of them due to the heat. But we're holding
You're
our own.
It.
Yeah, I can't believe it was 17 years ago that we had the Zaca fire. Almost exactly the same area too. But just hang in there. Everything is temporary, ladies and gentlemen. This will be over soon, and put up the signs of thanks and gratitude. Because these men and women deserve that, definitely. How about you?
Well, we're fine. I mean, we're downtown, so it's easy. So let's go to quick break, Richard.
Okay.
And then I've got a story about the Sex Pistols when we get back from the break. Don't turn that down, Becky. Back, it's Elizabeth Stewart. We're talking about things that have happened in the last week in the art world. And I've got a story for you about the Sex Pistols. In the 1970s, the Sex Pistols released a recording, God Save the Queen. And it was a scandalous recording because it had lyrics saying something about the monarchy was a fascist regime. And the powers that be forced the record company to withdraw 25,000 records. So as soon as they were issued, they were withdrawn from the market. So only a few records remain, and of course it went viral. Then the lyrics describing the monarchy as a fascist regime was scandalous enough that it went worldwide. But only a few of these records, the real records from the first pressing, very few existed. So it was recently sold by Wessex Auction Room, specialists in vinyl records in Britain, for 24,000 euros. So that's like $26,000 for one single record. That was just last week. So the Sex Pistols record made absolute history. The God Save the Queen sold for $25,000 at auction. Another thing, Richard, that's pretty interesting to me, just came out that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York for the first quarter put out a release yesterday that more than half of art history and art majors are underemployed. And they're saying that the visual and performing arts, art history and graphic design majors nationwide have the bleakest employment prospects across all college majors in the entire United States. Oh my goodness. So that means art historians that are, you know, in training, visual performing artists in training, graphic design majors, these people don't have much employment prospects out there, and they usually work in fields that are not there where they studied. And they usually, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that puts out these data reports, according to this report, many of them are working in fields that don't require a college degree at all. And I found that online you could plug in this online interactive chart that compares unemployment and underemployment rates, career median wages across popular college majors. And they can also compare commensurate data of people without college degrees. Let's see. So what does the data actually tell us? So I went online, took a look at this. As of February 2024, art history majors faced an 8% unemployment rate and a 62.3% underemployment rate. Despite having the highest level of education amongst the creative majors featured in the report, meaning that at least 45% had masters or more. And then we're talking to art historians. Fine arts majors, so art historians, art history, that's at the top of the heap for unemployment. That was my major. Fine arts majors finished in close second place with a 7.9% unemployment rate, but they have brighter employment placement with a 55% underemployment rate. And the next category, performing arts majors. They don't do so well either. They come through at 5.5% underemployment rate. They lead in underemployment out of all the creative fields. They are underemployed. In other words, they are usually working, if you're a performing arts major, you're usually working in not an associated field, but a different field that just to feed yourself. The next category is graphic designers. They only usually hold bachelor's degrees as opposed to performing arts and fine arts majors, but they have the lowest underemployment rate in the creative sectors. Well, what are the higher sectors? Industrial engineering, huge. Construction services, really, you know, these are majors that if you go into your college career in these majors, you're likely to be employed in your field. Industrial engineering, construction services, medical technical majors, engineering majors, they enjoy the highest job placements and the minimum six-figure median salaries by mid-career. So, you know, this is an interesting thing because the creative world, aspiring creatives, they did this study on a creative think tank. It's called Creatives Rebuild New York. They found that the majority of artists in New York State experience financial insecurity, despite the art and culture sectors accounting for almost 8% of New York's economy. So interesting that the arts don't actually always hold up in light of our economy. They said that more than half of the artists who participated in the study reported earning less than $25,000 a year. And 86% do not make more than $50,000 a year. And 50% rely on gig work and temporary unemployment in the creative classes. It's amazing. And of course, it's an interesting thing to be in the creative class because there's no wage protection. There's no real affordable healthcare options or any element of the social safety net that other kinds of workers enjoy. So I would suggest, Richard, that, you know, we start to rethink this, that we need to establish artists as labor. And we have to think of ways to improve the creative class here. It's so interesting when the Federal Reserve comes out and says art historians, visual artists, performing artists, and graphic, weakest unemployment prospects have very poor employment record. What do you think about that?
Well, I've heard the importance of the arts in society, in our civilization, the contribution that it makes, and I would tend to agree with you. I mean, what we do, whether we're authors, you know, writing books or otherwise, we are contributing to the social growth of our communities. And that's significant. I mean, yeah. I don't know if there have ever been any civilizations that didn't have the arts and so forth, performing and otherwise. That I mean, would not the cave paintings sort of be sort of that beginnings of the arts?
Yeah,
you know,
that's right. Yeah, no, it's inside of human beings for sure.
Yeah,
I got a story for you out of the University of Houston. An artist named Shazia Skiander. She's a sculptress. And she made a monument. The university paid her to do this outdoor sculpture, 18-foot tall bronze monument to women and justice. And what this sculpture looked like was a beautiful woman with a headdress on of like back curving ram's horns in a magnificent headdress and a beautiful kind of embroidered bronze hoop skirt. And a lacy collar, sort of reminiscent of the kind worn by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the late Supreme Court Justice. And it was a beautiful woman, very statuesque, very strong-looking woman. And like I said, 18-foot tall bronze. Well, somebody beheaded the bronze.
No.
July 8th of this month, somebody decided they were going to cut the head off the bronze. Why did they do that? Well, they said that the braided hair that kind of formed those, I don't know what you'd call it, but almost like ram's horns, or, you know, like a Princess Leia kind of side headgear, hairstyle. Somebody said that this was a satanic symbol.
Oh, please.
Yeah, and that this satanic symbol on a woman like that is so strong and so forthright that this was a wow. Christian group called the Texas Right to Life.
Oh,
they held a campus-wide protest just 2 days ago to keep this satanic abortion idol out of Texas.
Yeah, and angel wings are satanic too, because Lucifer has them.
Yeah, crazy. So, anyway, so this is a symbol of female autonomy that was made to be a symbol of female autonomy, and it was beheaded. They got in touch with the artist and said, you know, what are we going to do about this? Can you please put this head back on your beautiful sculpture? And it's a violent act of hate, but...
You need to move back close to your mic, Elizabeth. Move back close to your microphone. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Okay, she said it was a violent act of hate, but she does not want to repair or conceal it. She wants to expose it, leave it damaged. She said she'll make a new piece, but she'll never repair it. She requested the sculpture be left beheaded. And the university said, well, we respect the artist's wishes, and we're going to leave it beheaded.
I would, too.
Yeah.
I would also then put a plaque explaining who and why.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because to me, Richard, it's always been fascinating that sculpture takes the hit. I mean, if you think about some of the Confederate sculpture, you know, the generals on the Confederate side, that sculpture takes the hit. And it's always been so fascinating to me that things that have human form, I mean, this is a piece of bronze. It's nothing more than a piece of bronze, but it's made in the form of a human being. And therefore, you know, the sculpture takes the hit because it's in the form of a human. And so, conservators were called in to advise. Oh, and by the way, what do you think the title of the piece is?
Well, I'm curious if she changed the name of it before it was beheaded to a new name after it was beheaded.
No, it was given the name originally called Witness.
Oh, I like it. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this sculpture, and, you know, this is a big story right now because the same artist's work, she has a whole series of empowering women. Mm. And she's showing at the Venice Biennale right now. So she's also a MacArthur genius. So real big story in the news. Likewise, another sculptural story. I got to tell you this. A marble statue of the Greek god Hermes, full on, six, seven feet tall, was uncovered in an ancient Roman sewer in the Bulgarian village of Rupetite. Now, why is this important? It's important because somebody put it in a sewer for some reason or other.
Or Mike, well, no, wait a minute. Was it actually put in the sewer, or was the sewer built around it? So that's my question. Is it so? It was literally.
Okay, well,
it was.
I can answer that. This particular sewer was located near the Greek border. So this Bulgaria was partially, you know, it was in Bulgaria at the time. We're talking about 388 mm-hmm. CE. So it was called Heraclea at the time, and it was destroyed in an earthquake in the 300s. It was established in 300 BCE, mm-hmm. and 600 years later, it was destroyed in an earthquake. Now, Hermes was found in the sewer, which was older than the town, the older than the sculpture. And what the archaeologists were saying was that the way it was buried, wrapped beautifully, meant that it was carefully buried for a reason. Well, if you think about it, in the first 300 years of the common era, Christianity is taking over the world, and of course the ancient deity, Hermes is a messenger of the gods. This ancient deity was, of course, a symbol of the messenger of the gods in a pagan religion. But many times when the pagan sculptures were not allowed to be seen anymore, but everything pagan was forbidden. However, when they joined the new ideology, which was Christianity, they took care of their old deities. They wrapped them up carefully and buried them.
Hey, I love the stories of those civilizations, those cultures, who were converted, I use the term loosely, who protected their culture by hiding it, sometimes hiding in plain sight. And that's, of course, before we go to break, just say, and that's where the Irish came up with what we now know today as river dance. The dances were a method of communicating. I thought that, and I just love that. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So then this is, again, it's an example of the human form. So this sculpture of Hermes is, you know, a beautiful naked messenger god in male form. And, you know, he was buried with dignity in 300. So, you know, it's very, very interesting. Well, let's go to quick break. When we get back from the break, I think we have a guest waiting in the waiting room. Do we not, Richard?
Yes, we do.
Okay. So I want to talk with Jennifer when we get back from the break about what's happening in her world in the arts in Santa Barbara. Don't turn that dial. Back in a minute. Jennifer, this is Jennifer Jagua, and I'm talking to Jennifer about what she's doing in the art world. And my gosh, she's had a wonderful long career in material cultures, what the fancy word is, the world of things. Jennifer, can you hear me?
I can. I love that, material things. It's better than stuff, right?
Yeah, in the world of material culture. That's the
Yes, word. Material culture. I love that.
So tell me what you're doing now.
Well, you know, right now it's been an interesting shift for me because I had previously, as you know, been the sort of manager of the shops at the Music Academy for a number of years. And then just immediately post-COVID, the shops closed and that was end of a really amazing era. In which I grew up in. I used to go to the shops at the Music Academy, the Treasure House and the Rack with my mom when I was young, and we'd dig around for treasures. And so when I ended up there, it was kind of life coming full circle for me to be the one sort of curating those things as they came in and passing it on to the new owner. I never actually worked in that kind of environment before, and I loved it. I loved that process of, well, you start out sort of holding someone's hand as they release a family treasure or a personal treasure, and then you're the sort of caretaker temporarily until it finds its new home, transferring all that information about the history and the provenance of a particular to the new owner. And all of those relationships that develop in the process of that, something I had no idea that was something that I was going to become so attached to. And I loved it. So when I went to shops,
So Jennifer?
Hold on. Can you let me move to a different spot? Is this better?
Yes. Continue.
Is this better?
Continue, yes.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. So okay, great. Yeah, so that that process and that experience then turned into people calling me saying, We know you'll help us now that we've downsized, the house is sold and we have all these treasures. We don't want to just give them away. We don't want to do an estate sale. Can you help us find good homes for our things? And so that turned into a whole other business model for me, which I've been doing for the past 4 years. So it's just been an amazing transformation for me transition from being a serial entrepreneur in my own businesses to working for someone else to now back to working for myself and staying in this world of, what did you call them? Material.
Oh, material culture. So are you running sales?
Culture, yes. You know, I'm, I do pop-up sales here and there. I'm in a couple of shops, one up in Los Alamos, I'm in Sisters, which is kind of a antiques and gifts and home and dealers have different rooms. And I'm one of the rooms up there, filled with antiques and collectibles. And then here in Santa Barbara, the Art of Consignment, is on East Gutierrez. And I'm up in the attic. I rent out the attic and it's filled with treasures up there. So you have to sort of discover that, find me. And that's where I am. I'm not there physically. I just, I populate the upstairs with a lot of furniture and art, and you have to kind of discover it.
So you're in the consignment store on Gutierrez, right?
Correct.
Okay. Wonderful. And can you tell us, this is always interesting. Can you tell me, I can tell you for sure. I'll give you my story and then you give me yours. So, you know, there's such a thing in our industry as beginner's luck. So I've been appraising. I've been appraising for like 25 years, something like that. And I didn't start off, as an appraiser. I started off as a dealer, mm-hmm. and I was a young dealer, and I was a single mom, and I would kind of buy and sell, very quickly just to keep turnover going. The markup was never huge because I didn't want to wait. I was kind of, I wasn't the wealthiest single mom either. So, I was making a quick turnover as fast as I could. I bought a Asian screen that was rice paper with calligraphy, beautiful calligraphy all over the screen and small illustrations, but mostly calligraphy. And it was a 3-panel screen. I was probably, my son is how old? 35. So this maybe 35 years ago, something like this. And this screen, I was trading out of my house, my little rented house. Screen came in. I bought it for $50. And a dealer came in and said, what would you take for the screen? Well, in those days, Jennifer, I used to just say, well, okay, let me just mark it up again, keystone it. So I said, I'll sell it for $100, So he bought it. And it was, like I say, 30 plus years ago. I was a member of various museums. At the time, my favorite museum in the world was the Metropolitan in New York City, where my mom grew up. And so I used to get their magazine, used to come in the mail. Lo and behold, I get the magazine from the Met. On the cover of the magazine is my screen. Somebody donated it to the Met. It was rare. It was extremely rare. Han Dynasty. It was just amazing to read the description of it. And there was no telling how many thousands and thousands of dollars it was worth, but it was donated to the Met. It was a major mistake. And I learned from that. But you tell me your story, the one that got away.
Well, you know, I don't know that I have any that get away, because I can relate very strongly to the story you just told. But I also feel like, especially in our community has such a wealth of treasures and amazing art and artifacts. And when they come through our world, my world, even if I do know the value of it, I think it's such an amazing thing to have, to offer an experience where someone knows that they're getting this amazing deal, and they're getting it, and they makes them feel really good about the experience, where they are when they got that deal, who they got the deal from. And I don't know, there's just something about that. It's kind of, it's not charity, you know, but I mean, it's just a way of making everybody feel good. Yeah, so I don't know that I have one that got away necessarily, because I do a lot of research. When I first arrived at Treasure House, like I said, I'd never been in that business before, other than, you know, being with my mom or my grandmother, you know, thrifting or antiquing. So I've been on that side of it, on the other side of it. But I felt like every day I'd become a researcher, I'd become a student. I was like back in university doing research, you know, because things would come in and I would say, okay, I don't even know what that is, and I don't know what it's worth, and I don't know, what do you use it for? So I was always learning. It was so fun to that, all that discovery of things, and learning about, you know, even linens. Sometimes a linen would come in and it was a weird shape or a size, and you didn't know how it had been used. What was it used for? Certainly a lot of silver utensil, you know, serving ware, we don't use a lot of those things that we used to. So it's fun. And then obviously art, and like your screen, knowing how do you even figure out how old that is and where it came from, unless you have some expert person coming in. So yeah. Well, I mean, I grew up here in Santa Barbara, and my discovery of antiques started young when my grandmother would take us to the Alpha thrift store. I have two younger sisters, and we would do it. It was a kind of a competition or a contest. She'd give us each 50 cents, and we had 15 minutes, and we'd go through the Alpha thrift, and whoever came out with the best treasure, and she was, of course, the one and only judge of that. Whoever came out with this treasure got a double scoop of ice cream instead of a single scoop when we went out to the, you know, the thrifties on State Street. So that was our fun. That was sort of how I learned how to cull through things, and whether it be clothes and learning to discern, you know, between linen and silk versus polyester really fast, or picking out the porcelain, you know, the beautiful porcelain piece versus just some, you know, random china piece. So it was fun. We learned young. She trained us up.
So I have to tell you a story about the Music Academy treasure, the treasure box. And we do miss it, actually. Some of my clients are like, wow, we used to donate, give our stuff there. We just don't know where to go with our stuff. But at any rate, years ago, you know, the kind of clothing that you used to get in there was amazing, because a lot of it was, you know, very wealthy women. They were designer pieces. They were one of a kind in some cases. Sometimes they were made for the ladies that donated, et cetera. And I found a little black dress, of course. And it was kind of a lace on the bodice, and then a kind of a fitted skirt. And then at the end of this skirt, it had a kind of a big black ruffle. It was really different. And wore that to just a couple of events. My niece in New York saw a picture of me in that dress. And she said, oh, I'd love to have that for our prom. It wasn't a long dress. It was a cocktail length. I want to have that for our prom. Do you think I could borrow it? I said, sure. I sent it to New York. She was, in high school. I think she was a junior. And I said, you send me pictures of you and your date. I want to see how you look in that gown, in that little cocktail dress. Anyway, she was a budding artist at the time, Jennifer, and she cut it. She cut it. I don't know if she realized that it couldn't be put back together, but she cut it so that she just had the skirt remaining. She took the lace off the top, or the lace, the top off of the dress itself. And instead she put a black leotard on underneath, and it was very artistic. She painted her face. It was really interesting. And so it was the history of a dress I bought from you years ago, and how that transmuted itself into work of art on the other side of the country. Yeah. So, the shop that you managed had such far reaching tentacles.
It really did. It really did. And it's that community. Yeah, I think that's the part's missing, the most, is that people that don't necessarily, or not necessarily coming to the Academy for Music, but they're coming for the shops, but then they're on the campus, and then they're exposed to the programs and everything. It's not just that, again, that community giving, which, is very strong here in Santa Barbara. And to have a place where you feel good about where you're standing, and it's going to be the result of the sale of, the program and all that.
Well, let me ask another question. Let me ask another question, Jennifer, of you. So right now, today, we are, I think the pandemic changed a lot of the ways that people shop, and people don't actually go to shops as much as we used to during the pandemic, before the pandemic. And it seems like a lot of things have gone online. And you necessarily were telling me you had a physical presence on Gutierrez, where you're selling, and you've got a physical presence in Santa Ynez where you're selling. So my question would be, do you do much online?
I don't do anything online other than I have an Instagram page. And so when something extraordinary comes in, or I have an event, I do a lot of pop-up events. I'll post something there. And I'll always, if I have something, like I had a beautiful chinoiserie screen recently, and I put that up, and I always put the pricing and some details about it. And probably 90% of the time when I put something up like that, someone will message me and say I want it. So that's really the only online presence that I have. I don't have like an Etsy shop or and I don't sell on eBay, and I don't have a website, but I do everything on Instagram.
Well, I respect that. I really do. It's craziness. I mean, I have some clients that, instead of donating, for example, and taking the tax deduction, they will attempt to sell things on some of the platforms, iGavel, for example, FirstDibs, et cetera. And it's a lot of work. And you really have to be kind of an expert, to do such a thing. I mean, obviously eBay is easy. But the reason I don't really like myself, I don't really like eBay that much, is because it's too wide of a market. It's too broad of a market. I find that you can't get top dollar in many cases because it's too broad of a market. you know, if you went exactly to a specialty market, in other words, if you've got a work by a California painter, you would go to a place like John Moran Auctions, where that's all mm-hmm. they do. And, you know, mm-hmm. you this specialized market. I think eBay is right. so broad, it's very difficult to finesse a sale, I think, on well, such a platform.
Yeah, I agree with that. Also, I think it's also takes it out of the community, you know, and then you aren't able to necessarily transfer the story or give the provenance. It's just out there to some unknown person. Yeah.
That's very good. Jennifer, thank you very much for joining me. I sure appreciate it. I hope to see you
on
New
Terrace. Of course. Thanks for the invitation.
Sure.
Okay. Bye. Thanks, Elizabeth. Nice to chat with you. Bye.